Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Brains Matter. Before I start, I'd just like to wish all of you a happy new year for 2011. Today's episode will be part 2 of an interview with Steve Mirsky. If you haven't listened to part 1, I'd suggest you go back to episode 131 and listen to that one first. In the meantime, let's get straight into part 2. But we've talked about the fact that science is getting less airplay and less space in public newspapers, and well, public and private newspapers, but there is a fair amount of outcome from science communication. What I mean by that is it seems to make a difference for people, because I know in my example, even though I've just got quite a small podcast in comparison to a lot of the large media organisations out there, one of the things that I can be very proud of with this little show is that it's led to an elephants charity being formed. One of the listeners heard the series of interviews I did on Asian elephants with Professor Roger Short, and he was so inspired by the plight of the Asian elephant that he contacted the professor, and thank you, Glenn, and together they formed a charity called Never Forget Elephants to help try and save the Asian elephant in Thailand, Laos, Sri Lanka, India, and so on, and regular listeners will be familiar with that. So, you know, just a small show like this seems to be making a bit of an impact. So how do you think we can promote those kind of impacts to the general public, Steve?
Well, that's pretty impressive, and congratulations to you for having started the ball rolling on that.
Thank you.
Unable to come up with any specifics with, with a comparable effect to your elephant story, but I do know that the ease of communication and reception of communication now means that, for example, the Scientific American podcast, which really is in itself a very small operation within the much larger operation of the magazine, winds up being listened to all over the world. It really startles me sometimes when I see who our listeners are, who our followers are on Twitter, and where we get mail from and where we get comments posted from, because it's so much more of an international kind of community than I had ever expected. I mean, one of the things that probably aids that is that so many people around the world speak English, but it really is remarkable the outreach with just a few hundred thousand people maybe tuning in. We still, it's a really select group too. It's an audience that you're happy to be reaching, but we get mail from really the only continent I can't remember getting any mail from is Antarctica. And I'm sure that, with the unusually high percentage of scientists down there, I'm sure that somebody in Antarctica is listening.
I'm sure they are.
But I'm always shocked at how many people from Australia and Africa and Asia and South America and, of course, Europe and North America wind up getting in touch. And it's really kind of mind-boggling. It's also a reminder. Let me put it to you this way. Let's say you're in the stands at a football game, whatever football means in whatever country you're listening. Do not pick your nose. Because it will be on the internet tomorrow, and the entire world will see you pick your nose. So in one way, it's great because you can have this global outreach with such ease. On the other hand, we are all being watched and listened to at all times, in a really kind of snarky Big Brother way, where if you do something stupid in public, it will reach the entire world. So, just try not to act stupid in public, everybody.
And if you have a reasonable grounding in science, obviously you won't be acting stupid, will you?
Well, one would hope, although, it's not hard to think of a few very, very prominent scientists who have said some stupid things in public, but we need not discuss that now.
You were talking about the impact of the Scientific American podcast. I know in my case, your show in particular is one of the things that really got me inspired into doing what I'm doing as well.
Oh, well, good. Then I get to take some credit for the elephant story. Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I mean, one of the things that I really love about this medium is, now, I had a big advantage because we have the imprimatur of Scientific American to work with, and yet for a long time in the North American iTunes ranking of science and medicine podcasts, it would be Scientific American and some other programs that had a big media outlet backing them. But also in there was a podcast that was done by a college kid in Canada out of his dormitory room. And that would always be in the top five also. So here's this kid with a couple of $100 worth of equipment who is able to compete with massive broadcast outlets who are throwing the podcast up sort of as an afterthought. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it to a lesser degree, Scientific American was able to do that as well because we're a magazine able to compete with broadcast outlets who have millions of dollars worth of equipment with only literally hundreds of dollars worth of broadcast equipment on our part. And so we're a little player, even though we're a big player in the science world, we're a little player in, or a tiny player in the broadcast world, and we're able to compete with broadcasters. And then there's this kid who really takes it to the extreme, working out of his dormitory room in Canada, who's able to compete with everybody.
And I know that from a personal perspective too, because when I started the show a little over 4 years ago now, in the first 6 months or so, I was regularly in the top 10. But now with the advent of a lot of media outlets following the podcast path, I'm sort of dropping down into the top 30, top 40, top 50. But even so, that's not bad for a one-man band.
Sure, absolutely. And your absolute numbers of listeners has probably continued to rise. There's so much more competition out there that as your absolute numbers rise, your total ranking may drop. But, you know, the good news is you're actually still reaching more people all the time.
Do you come across instances where you have people saying, I listened to your show, I really enjoyed it, I played that episode to my children or I played that episode to my brother, it's changed their mind on topic X or topic Y or things like that?
Similar. I don't recall anybody writing in or calling in saying that it changed somebody's mind, but I've definitely heard from parents who said that they played something for their children because it illustrated a point about how you do science and how you think rationally, and so that's great to hear. And there's also been cases of people who themselves were not really particularly interested in science until they heard something and it kind of inspired them to go get more education in science, either informally or formally. I've heard from people who have decided to take additional science classes at their college because of something they heard or read in the magazine.
Things like that especially, I think, are quite inspiring. And I've just found an email from someone who sent me a note a little while ago, and I just thought I'd read it to you. And I think this gives a flavor of where I think science communication can really impact people. And it's from a guy named Jamie, and he's written in, I'm slowly catching up and having a wonderfully enlightening time. The way you explain stuff makes it easy for even me to understand with my Year 9 education. Something like that, you know, this kid's, or I don't know how old he is now, he's obviously left school in Year 9, wasn't inspired by science at the time, and yet listening to some forms of science communication, and it's inspired him to become interested in the topics again.
That's almost, if we can ever allow ourselves to think that what we do is important rather than just a nice way to make a living, then that's where it becomes important.
On the flip side of that, given that there are people who say things like what we've just heard, do you think that means there's a lack of focus on the quality of education that we give to children in schools? Why is there a need or a perceived need for shows such as yours to pick up that slack?
Well, I don't think that our program is has as its main purpose to pick up that educational slack. If it does so, that's great. You know, we really just want to be a multimedia outlet for science information. But if there is that slack that needs to be picked up in our educational systems all around the world, apparently, it relates back to in our previous discussion about how I think kids are naturally scientists, naturally curious about the world, and the way we teach science kind of beats it, beats that curiosity out of them. I don't know how many people I run into who just hated science in high school and never took it again after that. Clearly, we're doing something wrong in the way we present it to them, because it should be the most interesting thing you can be exposed to. Mm-hmm. And clearly, a lot of people who don't think they necessarily like science education still love to watch science programs on television or listen to programs like yours. And so there's got to be something. I'm no expert on education, so I can't prescribe a remedy, but there's got to be some way to make science more compelling for kids in, you know, I'm not sure what your school levels are called, but here, you know, kids who are 12 to 18 are in junior high school and then high school, and that's where we lose a lot of them, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's much different here. Our high school usually goes from years 7 to 12, which is probably a similar age range to what you described.
Right, exactly. Yep.
I know personally I was one of those possibly quite annoying children who always asked the question, why?
And right.
I see, you know, when you go to the park and to shopping centres and things like that, there are kids who ask why, and I think it, you know, there's probably a combination of attitude and opportunity. So the attitude part is, will the carers, the people surrounding those children, encourage it? I was fortunate enough to have a father who was a university professor, so when I asked why, he would either explain it or say, you know, showing my age a little bit here, let's go to the library.
Right.
And
it's so much easier to go to the library today, because the equivalent of the world's libraries is in your home for the most part. Anybody listening probably has a computer and an internet connection, and you can find out anything. So, you know, in addition, and it's fascinating to do, I do it all the time. In addition to finding out what that actor you're seeing on television also was in, you can also find out the answers to some interesting science questions.
Certainly, yeah. The opportunity aspect of it, which comes down to, does your school have the facilities, does your school have the right kind of teachers and things like that? And I think a combination of those, and this is just supposition from my end, but I think a combination of those can help influence whether children continue on with things like that. I know that for me, I was encouraged to ask questions and find out answers to those questions, and at the same time, I went to a school which had a pretty good science program.
Yeah, it's really crucial. I mean, I was very fortunate because, unfortunately, I had the bad kind of science education where by the time I took chemistry in high school, I was done. I didn't like my chemistry class. I didn't like the teacher. And I figured I was through with science. And a few years later, I just happened to get back into it for, you know, a series of things happened that got me interested in at least studying science some more. And at that point, I really liked it.
What were those things that pushed you back?
Well, I had spent a summer in a theater company doing Shakespeare, and at the end of that summer, I was in a car with a couple of other members of the company driving across the United States, and somebody had left a copy of the Somerset Maugham novel, The Razor's Edge, in the back of the car, and I started reading it. And the protagonist in that book is living in Paris for a while and winds up going to the Sorbonne to audit some science classes. And I was inspired to do the same thing when I got back home to New York City. And I took some science classes and I said, and this time at one of the local universities, I had very good professors. And so I got more and more interested in it. And I wound up matriculating and getting a degree and then another degree in chemistry. So, you know, that was a serendipitous series of events. I could just as easily have been, an unemployed actor at this point. This is better.
Those are the type of stories that, you know, make you really consider chance. And, you know, this could lead on to a topic about probability and so on. But I think stories like that are the really exciting stories that say, well, here's what inspired you. Here's the actual thing that you can talk about that inspired you to go into following up on science. And in your case, chemistry, which was something you didn't like, is it what you ended up specializing in?
Yeah, exactly, because I had better professors. And, you know, it's another example of the interplay of the arts and the sciences, because without the arts, I would never have found the sciences.
For me, I think the one particular thing that pushed me down the science path was when I was in grade one, so the age of 6 or 7, my dad bought a college-level biology book from the local secondhand bookstore, and I remember it was on the inside cover, it had written 5 cents on it, so it was obviously a second or third or fourth hand book from probably the 1950s or 60s, and I remember distinctly it had a yellow cover with a picture of an owl on the front. I read this book from cover to cover. I probably didn't understand more than half of it, but I just loved all of the Latin terms, the way they described the creatures, the way they described all the different aspects. And it wasn't just about animals, but it was about plants as well. And oddly enough, when I went to high school and university, I studied the physical sciences instead.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, now I am far more interested in biology and evolutionary biology than the physical sciences, but I too wound up studying chemistry and physics and discovered later that my real interests were in biology and evolutionary biology. So, but the great thing is you can constantly learn. You're always going to school in a way, and just because your formal education led to one thing, it doesn't mean that you can't continue to be educated throughout the rest of your life in whatever you find compelling. And in fact, the background that you pick up in whatever you study, in whatever science you study, is applicable, because you learn how to read scientific papers, you learn the vocabulary, you learn how to think like a scientist. So it's all good.
And we mentioned kids being natural scientists before. What's one of your favorite questions from a kid that surprised you or you found a bit unexpected but made you think, well, that really highlights the point?
It's not directly an answer to your question, but I wrote a column a long time ago about a researcher who, in a sort of Jonathan Swiftian way, was suggesting that the human race try to evolve to be shorter because we would use fewer resources this way. And also, according to some database analysis, people who are shorter, not super short, but, you know, shorter than average, have longer lives, and you have fewer cells in your body, so there's fewer opportunities for a genetic misfire where you might develop an array of mutations that can lead to cancer. So there were, in this guy's view, there were many good reasons to try to downsize the human race a bit. So I wound up getting a letter from a little kid in a grade school on the west coast of the U.S., who wrote to say, he was the shortest kid in his class, and he wrote to say that the article was really helpful to him because he gets made fun of by the other kids. And so he waved this article at them saying that, he was the future of the human race, and actually, you know, he's probably going to live longer and he's probably going to be healthier. And I wrote back and said that, first of all, if he was 12 years old and he was already reading Scientific American, I think he's going to do just fine.
Yes.
And it just, it really seemed to have empowered this kid and made him feel better about things. So, you know, that was a really terrific interaction.
It certainly was. And on that note, Steve Mirsky from Scientific American, I'd like to thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, my pleasure. Great talking to you.
And I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Steve Mirsky. Steve hosts the Science Talk and 60 Second Science podcasts from Scientific American, so you can hear more of him over there. In the meantime, I'll leave you with a quote from Jawaharlal Nehru. Life is like a game of cards. The hand that has dealt you is determinism. The way you play it is free will. Bye for now.
I don't know, most of the mail we get from kids is you know, from little creationist kids who are outraged.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now. Future.